We're continuing our sermon series looking at the book of Judges. So if you just joined us, we're a few weeks into this now. And we're taking the chance to look at what are called the flawed and the flawless. So some of these kind of people who are often sort of seen as heroes of the Bible in some way, who have these flaws, which is a bit of a cyclical issue within the book of Judges. And you'll have seen some of the series already, looking at people like Deborah and so on. And do go and have a look at those or listen to those different talks which are available on our website. I'm going to be taking a look at the story of Gideon, which Stuart has given me a very ambitious set of readings, which is three chapters of the book of Judges. So don't worry, I am not going to read all three chapters of the book of Judges. I'm aware that I do go on a little bit. So what I will do, though, is kind of focus down on a little bit on some of the kind of key aspects that I think from his life that share a little bit about his character and also about a flawless Redeemer too. But before I get there, I wanted to just share a little bit about this little app that I've got on my phone. Now, I don't know if you've seen this. This is called Google Photos, in which I kind of upload pictures of my kids to this kind of, it's called a stream. And so I upload it to this app, and it sort of pings all of my friends and relatives with cute pictures of my kids on a regular basis, basically. I can store and share pictures on there, and that really helps with distant family and friends who maybe don't see our two children on as regular basis. And I also get regular reminders. So you can just see on the screen here, you know, that it was 4 years ago that I went to Anglesey Abbey and looked at some of their dahlias. And we actually went there yesterday, did the same thing. 3 years ago that Lydia started stretching for the first time. And I also get these kind of cute reminders about, you know, you're a super dad, which I need at 5 o'clock in the morning. But like any dad, I do whip out my mobile phone at the least opportunity, really. It's any slight opportunity to show strangers pictures of my kids. So indulge me for a moment. Now, don't let these pictures deceive you. Okay, this was a reminder about a photo that I took 2 months ago, and there he is eating some, eating. He's got a lot of chocolate ice cream down his stomach there anyway. He's all ice cream and smiles now, but again, because of the app, I get to see that he's not always been like that. Oh, he's still cute though, isn't he? Look at that. I had another reminder this week about him two years ago, so this is when he's about 2 months old. And again, it all looks really cute, but it was a reminder to me of how challenging, extremely challenging, having a young baby is. He didn't sleep a lot. He cried a lot. And that meant that Elizabeth and I didn't sleep a lot and cried a lot as well. And the biggest thing that we really learned from this experience of having a little baby like this is that, you know, they are just 100% need. Okay, and many of the people in the room are nodding away. I can see that. They are the embodiment of neediness. They don't give much back, apart from in a nappy, and the occasional smile for the photo stream. But of course, he's now much more independent, isn't he? And he looks a little bit more like this. You know, he's kind of out and about, he's walking around, he's starting to talk a little bit more. But at the time, he was just on this little mat, and we could just about at this point put him down for 10 minutes and have a shower before he either started crying or again needed a nappy change. Imagine that. And he's getting more and more independent. But the world still does revolve around him. Okay? He can now communicate with us in ways other than screaming or crying. He can look us in the eye. He can point and even say words in a way that he couldn't when he was a little baby. But he got to set the terms of our relationship for a while. Now, I'm hoping, as I'm looking out in the room, that, you know, there's some people with older children, and I hope you'll tell me that this doesn't stay the same forever, this kind of demanding, crying, wanting to be picked up all the time, flapping their arms, pointing at things. It wouldn't be a good scenario, would it, if in, you know, he's older and he's still demanding to be picked up, still crying. Chantelle, I think they're trying to say something there. I think they're trying to say something about you. But I would pick... It would be a difficult situation if I was picking him up when he was 20 years old and having to calm him down. I'd say, whisper, get a job. And that's not a kind of mean thing to do at that age, is it? To want to provide for our children and to have our relationship defined by need. But there is a transition that happens when you go from being a child to being an adult, isn't there? Learning that the world doesn't revolve around me. We want, of course, healthy adult relationships where we don't flap our arms in the air and expect to be picked up and to have others meet our needs immediately. I don't get what I want all the time. That's called marriage. But we have to grow up and get over the idea that someone is going to come to our rescue. But that transition can be quite painful and quite frustrating. But there is one relationship where many of us, I think, perpetually come back to that quite baby mindset. And that's our relationship with God. We don't need an app on our phone to remind us of those moments, I'm sure, when we've expected God to make our life go better, that he will give me success in my career, help me raise my kids, have good friends, a healthy body. Of course, it is right to bring those needs to God. And occasionally he does provide in ways that we hope for and long for. But it can be a baby mindset when we expect that when we flap our arms and ask God to make our lives go a certain way according to our certain timelines, that he will just do that exactly as we want and when we want it. You might say, well, I'm no baby. That's not my relationship with God. But flip it the other way and then consider when things don't go your way or the way that you wanted them to go, when a prayer seemingly goes unanswered, when things fall apart. All too often, I think, our instinctive response is to be angry with God or to feel betrayed, to even start to question whether he's good or faithful. It can expose an assumption on our part that God's role in my life is to make things go better on my terms and my timelines. And when they don't go better, then the problem, in our mind at least, it lies squarely with God. Now, God does accommodate our baby-like demands sometimes. He answers our prayers. He solves our problems. He blesses us as we hoped. But sometimes he doesn't. Is it possible that he is gracious and faithful in those times too? That he's trying to grow us into an adult relationship so that if we scroll forward through the photo album, we would see his hand at work, even in the difficult teenage years and beyond, and that we would worship him regardless. It's a hard lesson to learn, but God promises to be with us, watching over us wherever we go, but not necessarily solving all of our everyday problems in the way we want and to our timescales. Now, let's turn to Judges chapter 6 and to see a little bit more about maybe how that plays out in this particular book. You'll see on the map behind me, you might be familiar with this, and Pardon the map, I'm a geographer, professional geographer by trade. I always look for a map to explain things. The people of Israel have escaped Egypt and the wilderness, you'll remember, in the book of Joshua. And they find themselves in the promised land with 12 tribes. There's no king. They coexist. And as we've seen in this series so far, they keep making quite bad decisions on a regular basis. That's largely because they fail to remove the Canaanite groups, the original people who were there when they moved into this land after the death of Joshua. And it means they increasingly get they learn bad habits and they see what's happening with these other Canaanite groups and they start to copy it, going against God's commands. They worship idols, for example. And it is increasingly hard as you work your way through the book of Judges to distinguish the people of God from those Canaanites that they found in the land originally. So let's look at Judges chapter 6 and read through the first part of the story of Gideon. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and they ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and didn't spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet, who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all the oppressors. I drove them out before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you have not listened to me. They're very difficult words, aren't they? And the prophets in the Bible, you'll see one of them speaking here, they're not fortune tellers. They're people who crop up at important points in the history of Israel to remind God's people about their relationship with God and the promises that he has made and the promises that they have made. And they point out on a regular basis when things are going wrong or when people are turning away from God. And at the end of the speech, I think you could leave with the impression that it's very depressing. God says, you've not listened to me. And that's the end of the speech from the prophet. Why does God seem so ticked off all the time, you might say? Well, we can just fast forward to step 11, to verse 11, where we read something slightly different. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abizrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. I find this greatly encouraging because all of that original story that we read at the beginning of Judges about these peoples and they're all falling out and they're all invading each other and stealing their camels, you feel like the big clash of nations in the background. And people are evidently saying, well, where is God in this at the time? And the answer is that God steps into that situation, sending an angel of the Lord, a messenger to a specific person to bring about his change of circumstance, to bring about a change in the heart of the people of Israel. And he sends a messenger to this man called Gideon. And I had to look up what Gideon means. It means hacker. So someone who cuts away at things, a little bit like a coal face, you know, chipping away at coal or wood. It's someone who's hacking away. And he finds himself in this wine press, and it would look a little bit like this. So here's a picture from an archaeological dig of a wine press, and the wine press is this big hole here. And people would be putting all their grapes in there, and they would be standing on them and sort of trodding down to make the wine, okay? So they'd be in there. It'd probably have a roof over the top of it to keep the heat out, but they'd be sitting there. And so to an ancient reader, you know, Gideon wouldn't sound a little bit absurd like it does to us, sitting in a wine press. It would actually be quite sad because he's threshing wheat in a place which is meant for wine. The reason he's doing that is because it's hidden away from these marauding powers who are out looking for people, okay, who they can either kind of take their food away from them or they can treat badly. So he's sitting there in this covered pit doing very dusty, very hard work, threshing the wheat from the stalks of the wheat, the grain from the stalks. It's a very dusty job. So he's probably found himself in a very sad situation. Now, what does the next part of Judges tell us about Gideon then? So here he is standing in the wine press. We take a look at verse 12, and we start to see the emergence of what I'm call his kind of baby-like faith a little bit. We can read in verse 12, when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. And look what he says, pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hands of Midian. And so we see here, just in Gideon's pardon me response, some of his basic assumptions about God. The angel says, the Lord is with you. And Gideon's effective response is, no, he's not. Look at the world around us with this big clash of armies, and we're feeling oppressed. If the Lord was with us, Gideon seems to suggest, would my life be falling apart? Would I be sat in this wine press, in this dusty place, doing this work? If God cared for us, the Midianites wouldn't be here. We'd be safe and happy. But isn't it also possible that God is with his people when things are going well, when he protects them, when he gives them plenty, but also with them in moments like this, when their lives are seemingly falling apart? It's God's grace to his people Israel, but in a very different form, in a form that a baby like Gideon doesn't necessarily like. Gideon sees God almost as his genie in a bottle. If God is with us, he would solve our problems. If the problems are here, God is not with us, he seems to suggest. And Gideon, in the rest of the story, is going to be taken on a journey that forces him to grow up, to have a more adult relationship with God. We can see that in a couple of different ways. So we look at verse 14. We start to see how God actually nurtures his faith and encourages him to grow up a little bit. The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hands. Am I not sending you?" "Pardon me, Lord," again, Gideon replied, "but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I'll be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive." Gideon replied, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you talking to me. Please don't go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And the Lord said, "I will wait until you return." Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour he made a bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered to take them under the oak. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth." And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand, and fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. So we've got some soggy bread and some meat on a rock, and the person who was speaking to him has just disappeared. Bit confusing, right? But not before God says, "I am with you, and I will wait here," on three different occasions. It doesn't happen every day that we see this kind of thing. But Gideon asks for a sign, something out of the normal, to prove that God was with him. And would you be more full of courage and faith that God was speaking to you if you saw him and you were actually communicating with him directly, if there was an angel there doing these miracles in front of you? Well, I would hope so. And so is Gideon. He's using this kind of growing faith, and he goes on eventually to smash up the altars to the other Canaanite gods in his father's house. And lots of people get very angry with him about offending these idols. But he says, "Well, actually, God is with me, and I'm going to do this." In verse 33, if you skip forward a little bit, we won't have the time to look at this, he's now called a vast army together. He's full of the Spirit of God. And we know that God blesses human leaders like him at this time with his Spirit, not because of the human plans, but because God is first and foremost committed to saving his people. So he's full of courage and trust. He's got this big army together, and they're going to try and push out the Midianites. Let's skip forward to verse 36. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor, and if there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." So there's still some kind of doubt here. There's still an if statement, isn't there? If you will save Israel. No matter what God has done, there is still doubt in Gideon's mind, and he wants another magic trick from God to prove that he is who he says he is. "God, can you come and pick me up?" The flapping wings, flapping arms of people like Elliot. How does God respond, though? Read in verse 38. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day, squeezed the fleece, and wrung out the dew, and a bowl full of water came out. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time, make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew." And that night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. And sometimes this kind of fleece story is held up by people about how, as an example of how we should discern God's will. Give me a little sign. Give me a little miracle. Is that what God wants us to take away from this story? Well, I would say no. The story tells us actually much more about Gideon. He's had a clear promise from God that he will be with him even in this battle. But he's still got that doubt, that fear and confusion. God's response, though, is gracious. He does this miracle. God relates to Gideon despite that kind of baby mindset, not because of it. And sometimes in our story, God will do that too, wonderfully. He does exactly what we wish. Our heart's desire is aligned with his, and that is God's grace. But that this is grace reminds us that God is not sort of contractually obligated to do that. He doesn't limit himself in that way. He has promised to be with us. And God repeatedly reminds Gideon of his gracious character, which is so important for the later stories of Judges, where the people of Israel fall so low that they forget who God is. So the second aspect of Gideon's story that I want to look at is his maturing faith. So if in Judges 6 it's this kind of quite childlike, help me, show me miracles to help me believe, in chapter 7 he's got a maturing faith. But that maturing faith is tested by, again, a gracious God. We can read here at the beginning of chapter 7 a little bit more about this battle that's brewing. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, he actually gets this kind of name, this kind of heroic name, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into their hands, or Israel would boast against me. My own strength has saved me. Now announce to the army, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remain. That's probably not the dream start for you as a general, is it, if two-thirds of your army suddenly walk off when they're given the first opportunity to do so. It's actually a nightmare start. Gideon could think, of course, that God is causing this. He's put all of his energy into building this massive army and calling all of Israel to go into fight. And then God sort of allows two-thirds of them to go away. You can start to see why he thinks, is God good all the time? But the most important thing about this story is actually that Gideon starts to acknowledge that he's not in charge of his own circumstances, that baby-like mindset. Instead, God is in control. We read in verse 4, "The Lord said to Gideon, 'There are still too many men, Gideon. Take them down to the water, and I will thin them out for you. If I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go.' So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, 'Separate those who lap the water with their tongues as a dog laps from those who kneel down to drink.' 300 of them drank from cupped hands, lapping like dogs. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go home.'" So if he was tearing his hair out at the beginning, he's probably ripping it out now. Okay, we've gone down from 30,000 down to 300. Everything is falling apart. Gideon was testing God. "Come to me, help me, revolve around me." And God was happy to do that by his grace. But now God is testing Gideon here. He's forcing him to grow up from that mindset. It's not healthy for Gideon to be in that kind of mindset anymore. His faith must mature. Is this collapsing army, we might say, actually the most gracious thing that God has done for Gideon? It forces him to realize he's not in charge. He's not sovereign over his life and his circumstances. If the battle's to be won, it's by God behind the scenes and not because of Gideon's strength. And if we read on in chapter 7, which we won't do for reasons of time, you'll see that God gives them victory with this small force. The Midianites are spooked out by the sound of breaking pots and the sight of flaming torches carried by these 300 people into thinking that there's a larger force about to fall upon them, and they run away. So God is not being difficult in forcing him to grow up away from that baby mindset. God's biggest priority is being with us and shaping us more into his image as mature believers with deep roots sunk into him, giving fruits of faith, hope, patience, and virtue. He promises to be with us, even in these battles, but not to be a genie in a bottle. So we've seen his baby-like faith and his maturing faith, and it would be easy to stop there and to say, look, he started badly, but he finished well. But of course, we know the book of Judges is not that simple. In fact, things start to go quite bad for Gideon. we know that the book of Judges is not just a simple set of stories, a moral tales, if you like, but it's also a warning. Bad things happen when Israel turns away from the God who called them out of slavery. And it's a sobering explanation of the human condition and points us really to the need for a rescuer who will save God's people. And like the other judges that we've already seen and that we'll look at in future weeks, Gideon forgets really that he's an instrument of God in the world, intended first and foremost to save Israel. And we can see all the way back in chapter 7 with that great battle that happened, I think the start of that fall, starting with the great victory in which the people shout for the Lord and for Gideon. And I think we can start to speculate that seeing that great success and seeing his name sung and even put on in the same sentence as the Lord's was a source of great pride for him, twisted into self-glorification. That courage and self-confidence that we saw in chapter 7 giving way to pride and even arrogance. And we can, if you were to look in the rest of the story, you'd also see that he starts to call out other people. He starts to call back some of those soldiers who'd left and God had called away. He starts to call back people from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh to finish off the task. And he even calls some other people from Ephraim to chase down the Midianites. Again, he's relying on his own ideas here, calling for human strength when God has actually said, I will do it with these 300 people. And we even see in chapter 8 that he goes so far as to think that he is the deliverer that Israel needs. And he starts to exact vengeance on local rulers who he beheads. And he even tortures and kills other Israelites in the towns of Succoth and Penuel who were skeptical of his pretensions to be a king, almost king-like. They were suspicious of him. And this leads to us, the second thing I just wanted to talk about his poor excuse for being a deliverer, it had real consequences for the rest of Israel. And this is how one commentator writes about this, and I thought this was really helpful. He said, the coward has become confident. He directs far-flung mopping up operations, which are effectively carried out. But the voice of the Lord is stilled, not to be heard for the balance of Gideon's narrative or the rest of the story. And the spirit of the Lord, which brought the courage to fight a far greater military force, seems to slip from Gideon's shoulders in the process. So Gideon's actions reveal that he's no longer selflessly committed to being an instrument of God's plan, no longer committed to saving God's people. And God cannot bless this with his spirit. And so the peace after the battle is fragile and temporary only. And it gets even worse for Gideon. He takes gifts of submission from those who've been victorious in the battle, gifts of gold, and he crafts it into an ephod, which is a kind of a garment of the high priest. And he turns it into an idol. If you look there in chapter 8, verse 27, all Israel prostituted themselves by worshipping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. He'd set up his own handiwork as an alternative object of worship, not God, but the effort that Gideon had made. We also read about how he had many concubines and wives. And this is a consequence for the rest of Israel. They forget God's promises again. They forget his presence. They forget his grace. And like Gideon at the beginning of the story, another generation does not hear about the greatness of God from the lips of their ancestors. We hear that no sooner had he died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals and did not remember the Lord their God who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. And if this sounds depressingly familiar, we must remember that the story of Gideon, like that in the rest of the book of Judges, is one of God's unending grace and faithfulness to a people who were routinely unfaithful. Gideon himself reflected some of those wider flaws of the Israelites at the time. He was tempted by his own power, even when God had proved gracious and victorious. And because of his limited legacy, Gideon is a poor excuse for a deliverer. Peace was limited in duration. Sin and oppression return, and exact a deadly price. But I want to end my final point, just to note that there is no human deliverer on the planet, none that's ever been, nor will there ever be, except our true Savior, Jesus Christ. We can read about that in some of these verses taken from the New Testament. In Matthew, reminding us that he is with us, just like God was with Jacob and like he was with Gideon. Surely I am with you always to the very ends of the age. He says in John, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And in Romans, we hear about that cycle of sin and condemnation being broken. There is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. Every teacher that we have, every minister, every parent, every friend, every family member, every mentor will at some point let us down. Every single one. And if we're in that baby-like mindset, we can take that very badly. But there is only one who will never fail us. One who is trustworthy every single time, who promises, as God did to Jacob back in Genesis, to be with us, watching over us, even when our lives are seemingly falling apart. And that is Jesus. He became like dust for us. He never failed. And unlike Gideon, he is flawless and accomplished. And he did everything that the Father asked him to do on our behalf. Because of him, we're delivered from our enemies and from the battles that we face. And because of him, we're being transformed into mighty men and women of valor. And that is a truth that our baby-like faith sometimes struggles to embrace. Things are difficult. Does God care? The answer is, he does. He always has. And he always will. Even when it feels like we're trapped in those cycles of sin and rebellion, like these Israelites, Jesus alone has the power to reach in without condemnation and break that cycle, forgiving those who put their trust in him. And my prayer really for us is that we take comfort that God is with us at work in our lives, no matter the situations that we find ourselves in. Would you pray with me?